A reading from the book of Ezekiel. The hand of Yahweh came upon me, and he brought me out by the spirit of Yahweh and set me down in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me all around them. There were very many lying in the valley, and they were very dry. He said to me, "Mortal, can these bones live?" I answered, "O Yahweh God, you know." Then he said to me, "Prophesy to these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh God to these bones, I will cause breath to enter you, and you shall live. I will lay sinews on you, and will cause flesh to come upon you, and cover you with skin, and put breath in you, and you shall live. And you shall know that I am Yahweh." So I prophesied as I had been commanded, and as I prophesied, suddenly there was a noise, a rattling, and the bones came together, bone to its bone. I looked, and there were sinews on them, and flesh had come upon them, and skin had covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, "Prophesy to the breath, prophesy, mortal, and say to the breath, Thus says Yahweh God, Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain that they may live." I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they lived, and stood on their feet, a vast multitude. Then he said to me, "Mortal, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say our bones are dried up, and our hope is lost. We are cut off completely. Therefore prophesy and say to them, Thus says Yahweh God, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from your graves, O my people, and I will bring you back to the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am Yahweh when I open your graves and bring you up from your graves, O my people. I will put my spirit within you, and you shall live. And I will place you on your own soil. Then you shall know that I, Yahweh, have spoken and will act, says Yahweh." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to John. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent a message to Jesus, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Accordingly, though Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, after having heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now trying to stone you, and are you going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Those who walk during the day do not stumble, because they see the light of this world. But those who walk at night stumble, because the light is not in them." After saying this, he told them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will be all right." Jesus, however, had been speaking about his death, but they thought that he was referring merely to sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. For your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, The teacher is here and he's calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, Where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, See how he loved him? But some of them said, Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, already there is a stench because he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you will always hear me. But I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. The Gospel of Christ.
Today's date on the calendar and the readings that we have heard from Ezekiel 37, the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones, and John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus, give us a little bit of a sneak preview of what is to come. Because next Sunday is Palm Sunday, and it launches us into Holy Week, that entire recreation, reenactment, and experience of Jesus's final week. And we get in these readings kind of something preparatory, something building anticipation for us about what is to come. And to fully appreciate what is being said here, I think it's important for us to take a closer look at what we read, especially in John chapter 10, so that we aren't simply making assumptions about what we think the chapter is about, but to get a better idea of what the context is for what Jesus is doing here, and what it is that's trying to be said by the gospel writer. We just remind you again that out of the four gospels, John is the last one to have been written and was written quite a bit differently than Mark, Matthew, and Luke were. Mark, Matthew, and Luke are kind of just telling the story of Jesus. Here's what happened. He did this, that, and the other thing and said these things, and away we go. But John, being written later on, has a particular structure that is designed to reflect the theology of the thinking of John and those who were following him. And so this gospel is meant to point to that theology, to paint a picture of what it is that they've come to conclude about Jesus and what that means for us. And so the way he has structured the book, and some of you will have heard this before, is that we see a couple of characteristics in the gospel that stand out a lot. One of them is that in the gospel of John, we see Jesus make 7 statements about who he is. These are statements where he says, I am. And the way that he says, I am in the gospel of John makes one think about the meaning of the name of the God of Israel, the name of Yahweh. And so when Jesus says, I am the bread of life, I am the good shepherd, I am the gate, and I am the resurrection and the life, we're meant to take a little bit more notice because of the way he makes that declaration. So that is one of the things we see in this passage. It's one of those statements that John brings up. But then John also brings up seven particular miracles of Jesus, what he calls signs, seven miraculous signs of Jesus. And these seven miraculous signs are not meant to represent the sum total of everything he did, but these are the ones that John wants to highlight in particular, starting with turning water into wine in John chapter 2, and ending with the seventh sign here in John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. And so this final sign is what we get to hear about today. So this chapter is rather remarkable because we've got these two things coming together, an I am statement and this final of these miraculous signs. And again, the purpose for structuring it this way is that John wants to make a point about who Jesus is. And in this particular passage, he's dealing with this theme of resurrection, which is obviously really important to us as Christians. It is the proclamation of Jesus' resurrection that gets everything going, really, as far as the spread of the gospel and the establishment of the church. But in order for us to grasp what's going on in Jesus' day, it's important for us to understand how this idea of resurrection came about and how it was being used in the time of Jesus among his people, which are the Israelites, the Jews. At the time that Jesus is doing his ministry, he's really pretty much spending all of his time, a couple of forays elsewhere, but most of it is just within Israel and speaking to a Jewish audience. And so what did they think about this whole idea of resurrection? We read John chapter 11, we kind of think like, wow, he raised Lazarus from the dead. But I don't think it's quite the way we think it would have been. Let me explain. When we start off in the beginning of the Hebrew Bible, there is no concept that there is life after death. There is no concept of resurrection at all. Basically, when you die, you go to Sheol. That's the place of the dead. That's just what it is. And that's everybody's plight. That's everybody's destination. We see that it is a place that is not life, so it's not as nice, it's not as enjoyable, and we even see the psalmist writing some psalms basically saying, oh, please do not let me see decay, do not let me go down to Sheol. You know, basically that's the wish. I want to stay alive is what he's basically saying. He's not saying, I don't want to go to Sheol, I'd rather go somewhere else. He's just saying, I don't want to die, because death was final. Death was the end. It was the tragic thing that happens. But then a change in development and hints of a different thought start to show up. Now, remembering that the Hebrew Bible was written at about 1000 BCE, when it's writing about things that would have happened earlier in the history, many of the ideas that they now had here were getting imported into this earlier writing. And we see this when it comes to death in a couple of ways. I think it talks about Abraham in this way, definitely Moses, I think Jacob and Joseph as well. But for some significant characters in the Hebrew Bible, rather than just saying that they died or they went to Sheol, it is said that they were gathered to their people or they were gathered to their fathers. Now, it's not very specific, but it's a suggestion that maybe there was a different result for these guys compared to everybody else. So we start to see a development of this thought of what happens after life has come to an end. And then in 1 Samuel chapter 2, we get a rather interesting verse. 1 Samuel chapter 2 is Hannah's song. Hannah is a woman who couldn't have kids, and she was pleading for God to be able to have a child. God granted that request, and she was pregnant and gave birth to Samuel. And then she delivers this song of praise. And in that song, in verse 6, she says that Yahweh is the one who kills and who gives life, who sends to Sheol and who raises up. And that's an interesting thing. Oh, like, sending to Sheol, that's a pretty final thing, and yet you're saying that God raises up, that God kills, but then God gives life. The fact that it's done in that order is starting to crack open this idea that people are thinking that there might be something after this life, that perhaps Sheol isn't quite as final as we might think. Well, as time progresses, we then hear about a couple of significant episodes in the history of Israel. After Saul, David, and Solomon and have their reign over the United Kingdom, the kingdom is divided up. And during this time, two important prophets emerge, one named Elijah and his successor, Elisha. And both of these men raise someone from the dead. In 1 Kings, Elijah encounters a woman who lived in a place called Zarephath, and she and her son were on their last legs. They were going to starve to death, and he makes this miraculous thing happen that they get to continue to live, and it's really lovely. But then the son dies, and Elijah raises him back to life. Elisha, in 2 Kings, encounters a Shunammite woman who is longing to have a son, and Elisha says to her, God's heard your prayer, and you're going to have a son. And so sure enough, the son is born to her, and years pass, and the son grows up, and he's out working in the field, and then he has a stroke or something, and he's dead. And now she's distraught. Why would God give me this gift of a son only to take him away? And Elisha goes and raises him from the dead. And then even more curiously, Elisha is dead, his body is in the grave, and then there was an altercation that involved somebody else dying and falling into Elisha's grave, but once he touches Elisha's bones, he comes back to life. So this idea of somebody coming back from the dead, of there being the resurrection of an individual who had died, is now part of Israel's story. One might wonder, given that they were dead for a relatively short period of time, did they make the journey to Sheol and were pulled back? Was it too short of a time for them to be dead that maybe they didn't get there? There's all these questions one might ask. But the point is, the story of someone being raised from the dead is already part of Jewish understanding. Elijah did it, and Elisha did it. And then we start to see this idea of resurrection being used in a more metaphorical sense. And here we turn to Ezekiel chapter 37, the Valley of Dry Bones. Ezekiel, the prophet, is writing during the time of the exile of the Israelites. And he has this vision of this Valley of Dry Bones, which means there were hundreds of people, maybe thousands, whatever, who were at one time here. They're all dead, and they've been there so long, there's no flesh left. All you have are bones that are about ready to turn to dust. And so when Ezekiel has this vision, and Yahweh says, can these bones live? Well, you'd expect that the honest answer would be no. But Ezekiel is smart. Oh, Yahweh, you know. And then it seems that it doesn't seem. The vision is that these bones then start to develop ligaments and sinews and muscle and flesh. And next thing you know, this mass of people is now standing up, a great army brought back to life from the dead. And the story of that vision is about a metaphor saying that Israel, which had once lived in its own land and had now been taken into exile, had essentially died as a nation, was no more, was now going to be restored, be brought back to life by Yahweh as a way of seeing that nation come back. And so this notion of resurrection here now is understood to be metaphorical. The language of life after death or death being turned into life is used in a different way. Then in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, the last chapter of the book, the setting of Daniel is during the exile, but in all likelihood it was written a couple or 300 years after that. But the book of Daniel has the first six chapters kind of telling the story of that time, and then the second six chapters are visions that Daniel has. And at the very, very end, we get an intriguing description, an intriguing explanation of things that now introduces a concept about life after death that hadn't really been embraced before. It says that there shall be a time of anguish such as never occurred since nations first came into existence. But at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. This is the first time that we see this idea in the Hebrew Bible, that after people have died, that there would be a resurrection with reward and consequence being part of the package. And it's interesting that it says many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. It doesn't say that everyone will, it just says many will. And then they will be divided up along those lines. And so this late addition shows that there's this further understanding that there would be a collective resurrection. that there would be a resurrection that is shared by many, not just an individual who died being brought back to life, but a collection of people, and not just in a metaphorical sense, like in Ezekiel chapter 37, but speaking of those who have actually literally died. In the book of 1 Enoch, which is Jewish literature written after this, you see another picture of there being this idea of resurrection and even what life might be like when someone dies, how is Sheol divided up and all of this, but with also the thought that people might leave there. And then in the book of 2 Maccabees, this is a story about what took place in the mid-160s in BCE when the Jews were being led by Judas Maccabeus to rise up against the Greek Empire, and they defeated the Greek Empire and got their religious freedom again. And as a result of one of these key battles, Judas Maccabeus, the leader, made sacrifices on behalf of all the Jewish soldiers who had died in the conflict. The idea being that he would make those sacrifices for whatever sins that they had committed. And it is said in the book of 2 Maccabees that he did this because of the resurrection. It was because of this expectation that there would be a life after this one that he wanted to make sure his soldiers who fought and died would be assured to be included in that. So this idea of a resurrection after this life took more traction, and people were making action and taking action specifically because of that understanding. But as we roll into the time of Jesus, we begin to discover that not everybody agreed. Two of the key groups that Jesus conflicted were the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection or in angels or in the spirit, right? The Pharisees did. And so the Sadducees were the ones who, because they didn't believe in the resurrection, asked Jesus the question. There was this man who had seven wives. So in the resurrection, whose wife? No, there was this woman who had seven husbands, one after the other, after the other, after each one died. So in the resurrection, whose husband will she be? You know, they're basically mocking this whole notion. And Jesus answers in his usual confounding way. But they brought up that question because they didn't believe in a resurrection. Later on in the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul gets called up in front of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, and they're calling him up on the carpet for him talking to Gentiles and all these things. And when he gets there and he sees that the Sanhedrin is made up of Sadducees and Pharisees, he says to them, I want you to know that I'm standing here right now because of my proclamation of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The moment he says that, well, the Sadducees get up in arms because he's bringing up the resurrection. And the Pharisees are going, hey, you know, maybe this guy isn't quite so bad because at least he believes in the resurrection, not like you guys. And there ends up being this whole conflict between them. It was kind of this brilliant political thing for Paul to do. So not everybody believed in this, which might help explain Martha's answer to Jesus in John chapter 11. Because when she's saying to Jesus, look, if only you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him. Meaning she probably knows that Elijah and Elisha had raised people from the dead. And perhaps Jesus might do the same thing at least. But Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. But then she says what she really says, what she really believes. I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. That's where Martha's at. She is one of the ones who believes in the resurrection collectively at the last day. And that's what she says. So she's sad that her brother died, but she isn't completely heartbroken because she believes he'll rise in the resurrection. So you've got this sense that this is going on. And even Jesus makes references to this in a way that simply takes it as being so. In Luke chapter 14, he says to someone who invited him to a dinner, he said, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors in case they may invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. And so Jesus brings this resurrection up without any context of talking about anything he's going to do about it, but the fact that it is already something that is part of the Jewish mindset that Jesus also has as his mindset. And he calls people to think about what they're doing in light of this resurrection. So what's going on here? We've got John chapter 11 with Jesus talking about the resurrection, but in a really interesting way. Well, before we come back and visit that, let's take a look at a couple of other things that were written before the Gospel of John was written. We see this ongoing development of this idea. In Acts chapter 4, early on, as the Christians are going out and sharing the gospel, we are told that many of the Sadducees were much annoyed because they were teaching the people and proclaiming that in Jesus there is the resurrection of the dead. The issue isn't really to the Sadducees that they're preaching about Jesus, that they're preaching that in Jesus there is the resurrection of the dead. So once again, we've got this conflict, this disbelief on their part. But then for those who embrace it, in Romans chapter 6, the Apostle Paul spends time talking about the resurrection and what it means for us. And where he goes with it is really interesting. He says, "Do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Therefore, we have been buried with him by baptism into death, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life." That's an interesting statement because, in this case, death and resurrection is being used by Paul metaphorically. Even though he believes in Jesus' actual resurrection, he's applying it metaphorically. All of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death. Well, that can't mean that we literally experienced the same death Jesus did. None of us have been crucified. And even the act of baptism is not an actual recreation of Jesus' death, but it is the sign that shows that we're identifying with Jesus' death. He who knew no sin became sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. And so this participation in the death of Christ is not to be taken literally, we are not dying, but there is an awareness that something is being put to death, as it were, namely our sinful nature, that part that doesn't always obey God. So then, when we go to the other side, just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, well, here we're not talking about a literal shared experience either, because you can't do a metaphor on the first half and then flip it to being literal on the other half. And he declares what this is about at the end. So we too might walk in newness of life. What does it mean in this passage to be sharing in the resurrection of Christ? It means walking in newness of life without having had to literally die beforehand to be literally raised. He goes on, "If we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his." And so again, unless the death that we are united in is literal, why would we think that the resurrection would be literal? Paul is applying these concepts and showing us multiple layers of understanding and experiencing of it. Now that we get to John chapter 11, and look again at what Jesus said, we see even more of this. When Jesus said to her, when Martha said to Jesus, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day," it almost seems like Jesus wasn't completely satisfied with that answer. He doesn't correct her, but he gives this "I am" statement. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live." And so this is a really cool statement. And what is happening is Jesus is stepping forward to say, when it comes to this resurrection you're talking about, the resurrection at the last day, well, I'm the one who's responsible for that. I'm the one who is embodying that. I am the one who is bringing all of that about. And so he gives this promise. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. Well that's a great promise. That there is life to come after this. You know what, Martha? Actually, you're right. There is a resurrection, but I want you to know that it's all about me. But then he makes another statement that once again shows the different levels and layers of understanding. Because he goes on and says, "Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die." What? "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die." Well, wait a minute. You just said that even if they die, they'll live. What do you mean they'll never die? There's been 2,000 years of Christians dying everywhere. Do you mean that they would just live forever? Then why didn't you just say that? If we are trying to take this statement as being all about the literalness of death and the literalness of resurrection, then it really doesn't make any sense, because here's the other piece. You can't have resurrection unless you actually die, right? You can't come back from the dead unless you die first. So how can you experience resurrection if you never die? What the Gospel of John is doing here is trying to take all of these factors and facets of this notion of resurrection, the literal idea of people coming back from the dead, the symbolic idea of life coming back to an exiled people, the idea of sharing in Jesus' death on the cross by seeing our sinful nature crucified and put to death, but then us rising to new life in that sense, and then this whole idea of the collective resurrection at the end. All of these things are being brought together. The point being that the statement Jesus makes is what is all important. Everything that there is to consider about the resurrection is centered on Jesus. Remember, the Gospel of John highlights the fact that Jesus is is God incarnate from eternity past. The second person of the Trinity, if you will, though John would have had no notion of that writing it down at the time. But this is what is being communicated. Whatever there is to understand about the resurrection, literal, symbolic, figurative, all of these different ways and layers in which it is to be understood, this declaration is that Jesus is the one who encapsulates it all. This is where we see this sneak preview of what is to come, and especially this story of Lazarus. You know, the other Gospels also recorded Jesus raising people from the dead. A widow who had lost her only son, he raised him up. A young girl who was dead, he said, she's not dead, she's only asleep. And they all laugh at him because they knew she was good and dead. But she says, little girl, I say to you, arise. And he raises her up. He's raised two other people from the dead. And those aren't even covered with the same kind of panache as this account is. But this account is setting us up for Holy Week. Did you notice that Lazarus was put in a tomb? That there was a stone rolled in front of the tomb? Lazarus was in his grave for 4 days. In just a few chapters, we find out that Jesus would be put in a tomb, that the stone that was put in front of it would be rolled away. He would be there only for 3 days, but he comes out of his tomb too. The Gospel of John is setting us up for Holy Week. The Gospel of John is wanting us to comprehend that what it is that we're going to explore, starting with Palm Sunday and ending on Easter Sunday. Not that Holy Week was a thing back when he was writing, but this is what we are being prepared for today. And so my encouragement to you this morning is to worry less about exactly what the details are of exactly what the resurrection is supposed to look like, and is it everybody or only many people, and is there a resurrection to righteousness or to condemnation, or are we talking something symbolic, or does it mean something else? Do we use it as metaphor? Is it going to be literal? Whatever. Just understand that Jesus is behind that all. That we look to Jesus for the understanding of what it means to live in light of the notion of the resurrection. Whether that's where our treasure is, so that our heart will be there too, or whether because of this idea of being identified with his death, we may live in fullness of life. No matter how you slice it, this idea of death being overcome, death that was once understood to be final, is no longer final. In Christ. He is the resurrection and the life. He is the one that takes all of these things together. It's no longer just Yahweh, the God of Israel, in that sense. But he, who is for all people, is the one who embraces this. And as we follow his example, as we consider his teachings, as we consider and walk with him through Holy Week and experience in our minds what it is that he went through, we can find ourselves walking in his footsteps and living that full life, knowing that there's no need to be afraid, there's no need to be concerned, but our lives are in the hands of God. So, get ready for a great Holy Week next week. Amen.